Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review. This is Weekly Comics Spotlight number 655 for comics originally released on February 26th, 2020, and we are back to our regular format of one DC, one Marvel, and one other. So with that, let's get going and talk about our DC comic, which is Leviathan Dawn number 1.
It's back. Leviathan.
it's back. This continues the story from Event Leviathan, which I think continued the story from, was it Leviathan Rising?
I think so, and that kind of came out of Superman and action, things like that.
I'm almost wondering if Bendis should have just done an ongoing title, either called Leviathan or something else, that is where all these super spy story type stuff take place.
Yeah, probably. I could see this, you know, after having read all this Leviathan stuff, it'll probably read much better to me as a collection of all those stories, because there's so many twists and turns, and he does these little intrigue things. But, you know, when you space out the stories for months apart, you forget about those things.
Well, and I think the spacing is a lot of it, because this issue was pretty much an assembly of a team kind of an issue.
Exactly. Bring the band together. Let's get them all here.
And it did it kind of leisurely and kind of slowly.
Very slow. It felt almost sluggish reading it.
Yeah, so I wasn't the only one with that feeling.
No, I definitely felt that way.
I think if they had gotten this to where it could have been released on a monthly basis, that would have helped the pacing.
Yes.
I think if they had been able to launch it almost as if it were replacing the Silencer title where Leviathan had shown up.
Yep.
And
yep.
Had that kind of, hey, Silencer's story's done, but follow Leviathan and maybe she'll show up, maybe she won't, over in this new book. And then when this story, because it's going to go into another, I guess, miniseries after this, when that plays out, it seems like it will have set the scene for future spy-type stuff, either under the same kind of umbrella title or maybe a different one.
Yeah, exactly. That would have played out really well if they would have done it that way, but it's kind of odd. You had that Event Leviathan, then there's a long pause, and then here's this one shot, you know, just randomly here, and then it just feels like it's too spaced out for what he's trying to do.
I agree, and I also don't think it benefited it to be called Event Leviathan.
Yeah, that was not much of an event.
Again, the term event has a particular meaning in comics, and it's not even a common meaning, because, you know, some people think of it of like a Crisis on Infinite Earths or a Secret War, Civil War kind of a thing over at Marvel, where like everybody in the universe is somehow involved in this.
Yeah, and it almost felt like he tried to address that it wasn't much of an event in this comic, because when there's the gathering of the Leviathan group, they keep on saying, oh, you know, so-and-so, or what happened with the event? The event didn't go through. The event Leviathan, I'm like, why are they calling it the event? That's just so bizarre.
Well, as if it were a singular event, and really what had happened was the taking out of multiple agencies, so it's not one thing.
Exactly, and you wouldn't see it as, if they are Leviathan, you wouldn't think they would call it the Event Leviathan, you know, they would call it something else, you know, Project This, or Codename This, or whatever, but it just seemed kind of odd. It almost seemed like he tried to address that there to kind of hype it up and say, yes, it was an event, and it's because that was the code name.
Well, if it had been Codename Leviathan, or Operation Leviathan, or something like that, then they could have done the series of miniseries with, as each one completed, you have that tag at the front, Operation Codename or whatever.
Yeah.
And then flip it out to the next thing.
That would have been made way more sense. And actually, I think it would have read really cool if you're reading this like spy type story, this intrigue, this subterfuge in this omnibus or hardcover that comes out. And when you're reading it back to back, it might have been like a really cool story. Because when you're reading a story that's a story with a lot of spy stuff, a lot of intrigue, a lot of twists and turns in the plot, you really got it almost, it becomes a page turner. From page to page, you'll pick up what happened maybe in the last chapter. And when you space that out over months and months and months, it doesn't have the same impact.
Yeah. Well, and I think part of it is not just that it's a long duration, but it feels like we're still playing out the same story.
The exact same story.
I would have based one of my favorite titles from the 90s was Checkmate, which was the DC super spy agency of the day. It had cool costumes, cool concept, whatever. I would almost, if I were going to do a super spy agency in the modern DC universe, I would use Checkmate as the kind of the branding and the look of it, but I would actually use Black Cat over at Marvel as kind of the storytelling template, where she's doing heist after heist after heist.
Yep.
You've got a lot of good done-in-one type stories, and use that to have kind of an umbrella reach to where it's like, hey, at one point, you know, this organization, Checkmate or whatever, is you know, investigating the Daily Planet because of this whole Superman Clark Kent thing. What's going on? Who knew what when or something?
Yeah, exactly. That would be really cool. The way that they've done that, it's almost like a done-in-one story, but at the same time, it's a continuing narrative, but you can jump in at any point. And that's not what we have here.
No, here it's all almost, I don't want to say self-referential, but so in-game or whatever for the spy agencies that really nobody else is involved.
Yeah, and I would not want to be the reader who picked this up, just seeing, you know, the number one on the cover, having not read Leviathan, and also having not read Action and Superman, because a lot of stuff was building up into those books in there. And if you didn't know that, and you're like, oh, I want to read about this thing, you may be confused about what's going on.
Yeah, this was not accessible. It was not a one-shot in any way, shape, or form other than the titling of it.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that was a bit of a mistake.
I agree. That's really how I felt with it. It was the getting the band together. So you have this build-up to building a new Checkmate, which is cool. But at the same time, it's just referencing a lot of what's happened in the past event. Not much momentum going forward other than the plot twist at the end, which I don't know how much of a cool twist that is. I mean, did that get you excited?
Not a whole lot about this got me excited.
Me neither.
You know, it was one of those things where it felt, again, indulgent is a word I want to use. The bit there at the end where they do a status quo change for part of the DC universe kind of sort of made sense, kind of sort of didn't make sense. It felt very Marvel-ish.
Yeah.
Not DC-ish.
Yep, I would agree.
But the story kind of failed to hook me at the beginning because so much of it was centered around this Kingsley Jacob and his arc through most of the issue. And I'm like, I don't recognize him. I assume he's a new character. I just don't know. I didn't recognize him, so he's either really new or really obscure.
Yeah, I don't know who he is, so I assumed you might know. But yeah, no clue who he was, and I didn't really care after reading this.
I felt like it should have been King Faraday in that role, because he's one of the other kind of established spy types. Not quite a Nick Fury for DC, but kind of, sort of.
Yeah.
And this guy, maybe he's filling that role, I don't know. But then also, just what they've been doing with the Leviathan character, and of course, having a character Leviathan and a group Leviathan, that's not confusing, he said sarcastically. I don't like what they're doing with the character Leviathan, who he is and what he looks like and such. I want to like this more than I am.
Yeah, that's the thing. When they were building up to the event, I was getting really excited because there was almost like a boiling point. And this happened with Bendis over at Marvel, too, when he's writing. So he would get this big story going, the ball rolling, and everyone would be so excited for it. And then he'd get to the main, you know, plot or main point or the main story. And, you know, more times than not, it kind of fell on its face. And he did that a little bit at Marvel, you know. It's almost like he's better at doing the build-up than the payoff at the end. And so that's what I felt like we got a little bit with Event Leviathan. I feel like, okay, he's trying to build up again for another, and I fear landing on my face and not enjoying it.
Yeah, I hope that's not the case, but I do wonder.
Yeah, and I'm a Bendis fan, but it also felt like he was trying to tap into his, you know, he started off doing crime stories, and he's really trying to tap into the crime and mystery stuff here. And crime books are fine, but it's not really my preference. And so when he starts getting into that, it's okay. It's just not where I want to be.
I think And I hadn't been thinking this when I read this, but based on the comments you're making, I think he should partner with Greg Rucka on this kind of a story.
Oh my God, that would be amazing. Him bringing in, like, him writing Lois Lane is very good. I think he would. Bendis has the ideas. Almost Rucka should be scripting this whole thing.
Rucka can, I mean, he's got the follow through. He's got the meticulousness.
Yeah.
And he also did Gotham Central. He's got the DC and the crime aspect of it. Super Spy is a little different, but, and he's, you know, Rucka's got that down too.
Yep.
I agree. Is something that I think a team of writers, to where they could cycle through different people, take different parts, whatever. They really could have this be a hard hitting. You've got these super powered individuals in the world and you need an international spy organization. Yeah, it's going to have a little infighting, but it's there to keep the world safe.
Almost like, you know, you could almost see this being like, maybe not at that level, but like a Dawn of X type thing with Marvel and Hickman, what they've done, where, hey, they could have rolled this out. Hey, we're building this big thing, this spy subterfuge, international, you know, intrigue and what's going on. And you could have three or four writers writing this and building it and playing off of each other, bouncing ideas off and kind of tying the books in a little bit tighter and yet reading well on their own. And instead, Bendis is doing his own thing, which is good, but it seems like he goes here and he put in a lot of fluff. And I don't know if it's because he's writing a lot of books, but it just seems like it just felt like some filler and a lot of information, a lot of dialogue, but not a lot happening.
It took too long in this issue to get the team together. It's unclear why this group and what are they going to do, and we're not going to find that out until the next, you know, miniseries or one-shot or whatever it is.
Yeah, and I guess my memory's not that good, but the page where they're showing the whole group,
mm-hmm.
the guy in the lower right, I thought he was not there. I thought he was gone, but I guess he's there. But I guess they did take him away, but I was kind of surprised.
The one in the lower right is actually one of the few that makes sense for this kind of an organization.
Yeah, I just how it happened in the book when seen, I thought, wow, we're not going to see that character for a while.
Yeah, the way they handled it was a little kind of weird.
Yeah. Anyways, it's kind of funny when they roused him, I would say.
Yeah, and it's a very, very different direction than how that character originally appeared back in the 80s.
Yeah.
Which is fine. Characters have to evolve.
I did some research, so yeah, I saw the picture. I was like, and the, you know, behind, and I was like, yeah, very different. Very, very different.
Yeah, yeah. Much more colorful back in the day.
Yeah.
There's aspects of this that are okay. I think it was slow. I don't think it worked as a standalone one shot. I like Checkmate, which is referenced here. I want to see where they go with it. But would I recommend picking up this particular issue? No, probably not really. And I'm going to go with like a C+ on this, and I feel I'm being a little charitable doing that.
You know what? That's kind of funny, because when I read it through the first time, I was like, man, this is really boring, kind of slow. I mean, there's a ton of information, but I'm just not enjoying it. At the very end, I enjoyed a little bit, you know, with the maybe it'll be cool, the direction they're taking it. But I went from a C to a C+ because of that. And like you said, I wouldn't recommend it to anyone unless you are really into Event Leviathan. And actually, going forward, I question if I want to buy any more of the Event Leviathan things. Or the Leviathan things, because I'm just not enjoying it very much.
The name of the next one is Leviathan Checkmate.
Oh, so okay.
That Event Leviathan Checkmate, that's at least got me intrigued, because I like the old Checkmate series.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
Yeah, and I think, was it already solicited?
I am not sure.
Me neither. If it came out in the last previews, I probably already pre-ordered it. But we'll see. My memory's not that great. But, you know, I'm kind of like on the fence, because I'm becoming a little more judicious with what I'm picking and reading. Mm-hmm. So this one left me feeling like, do I really want to read this? And it could be really cool. The next one could be much better. It's just this issue kind of bored me.
Well, if the next stuff doesn't really pick up the pace or get a lot more interesting, it's getting a much shorter leash for me. He's had time. He's had, what, 8 issues now to do some stuff. And that's not even counting the stuff over in action. So, I mean, this story's had like at least a dozen issues or more to play out on, and it feels like we're just getting started.
Exactly. We need some payoff now, Mr. Bendis.
You know, he had the shakeup of the whole super spy stuff in the DC universe, and he still hasn't put the pieces back together to whatever the new status quo is going to be.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so we're kind of in limbo right now.
Yeah, yeah. Shall we move on to our Marvel book?
That sounds good.
This is X-Men number 7, and this is dealing with the whole concept of resurrection protocols with the mutants and such.
Yeah.
And I was curious about this one because it's like, okay, they're going to explain some stuff. That's good. I'm curious about this. And then I'm reading the issue, and it immediately brings up the question of the Crucible. And I'm like, what is this Crucible thing?
Yeah.
And at first, all I know is it involves watching a mutant die. Okay, that doesn't really narrow it down for most mutant comics these days, does it?
Not very much.
We got a little bit of a history lesson on the No More Mutants stuff, and it's like, okay, heavy exposition, why are we getting it? And then this is why we're getting it. So it answered some questions.
Yeah.
But it left me with some others.
Yeah, and what was cool for me is I went into it thinking one thing, and it gets tougher to do the more comics you read, and then it totally turned into something different while at the same time altogether intriguing and really cool and making me want more. So that's a good sign. But I agree with you. It answered a lot of things. It left a lot more questions. And now I was like, I read the title of this issue again, Faith, and it made sense. And it was really cool for me how this almost dealt with, well, it dealt a lot with religion. It dealt a lot with faith. It dealt a lot with resurrection and death and people's views on things inside of a mutant utopia. And so you start looking at the pieces as almost like becoming like members of a clergy or members of a godhead or something. And it's really – so I think there's multiple layers in here how you could read it.
Absolutely, and they dived a lot deeper into the potential religious significance of resurrection and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Certainly more so than I was expecting, but I enjoyed that part. I, from the solicit, was thinking it was going to focus on the five who did the resurrection.
I did too when I read that.
And they barely show up here, if at all.
Yeah, they were kind of like spoken of as like almost like these otherworldly, the five, you know, if all the mutants died tomorrow, you know, it'd be such a strain on the five. And so the reason behind the resurrection protocols and things like that. But I agree with you. It's really cool because I expected to have those characters and the focal point of how it's working, maybe what's going on. And yet he totally took us on a different narrative into how it's becoming. Basically, you're seeing a society and a culture where if death doesn't have a meaning or if something happens, which right now, we've kind of talked about it. Everyone knows about it. It's not really a spoiler, but characters can resurrect. Does that change the culture? Does that change religion? Does that change how you perceive things? How do you see souls? And I was just like so intrigued with it. It's very cool.
Well, let's kick that up a notch. Does it change the story?
I think it might.
I think it has to, because as of now, death has no lasting ramification for mutants. So from a narrative point of view, it's kind of neutered and pointless.
Yep.
Being rendered powerless, like the whole No More Mutants thing, that was touched on here.
Yes, it was.
So we have an answer to that. So really, the only thing that can have a lasting repercussion for a mutant in this day and age of the X-Men is being exiled.
That's it. Very much so. That's the only thing that can. And, you know, it's kind of funny because one character's basically living in exile, but not by her own doing, you know, or not by choices she's made, and that's another one of my favorite books over in the Dawn of X with the Marauders. But I mean, this is just such a, like I said, deep book on many levels. I read through it twice and I enjoyed it as much as I did the first time reading it the second time.
What was interesting is this was the first Crucible, so we're seeing the start of this process.
Yes.
You know, what it is, what it means, how you go through it and stuff. And I was curious why the particular person was chosen for the first one. And I've got some one or two theories of it's kind of who you know and who you are versus what you can do.
Yeah, I could see that.
Because it seemed like, I don't know how many depowered mutants off the top of my head there are. I mean, there's tons of them. I'm sure there's somebody that had a much more useful, meaningful, or leverageable power set than this particular person.
Exactly. This character didn't seem all important to the narrative going forward.
Agreed. I think there are one or two people in the narrative who would disagree.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
But I think you could say that for any one of the mutants. Somebody's attached to them and say, well, they're important enough for this.
Yes, I agree. Now, one other thing that I found very weird was interaction between Cyclops and Logan at the very beginning.
Yeah, I was thinking that because one of the other things that seems to have no narrative sway anymore is the concept of the love triangle.
Yeah, I was like, it almost seemed like it was like inviting along a third wheel. I'm like, interesting. I don't know what's going on there.
It almost reminded me of the scenes at the end of Boston Legal.
Yes, it was just so bizarre. I read that, and at first I was thinking, what? No way. And then it played out where it's like, it's so weird. It's almost like almost like these people are in heaven. Like they are beyond death themselves. You know, like
they are.
Yeah, Krakoa is like a heaven for them. And, you know, and they are not subject to death. They have these powers, and they're at peace all with each other. You don't have the you do have some bickering and stuff, but there's not the battles, there's not the hatred and stuff like that. So it's really weird that we see a heaven created for the mutant people, and I'm waiting for the fall from heaven to happen.
I'm expecting a handful of people to get literally exiled.
Yep.
And in 6 months to a year, we're going to have a title called Exiles, because let's face it, we've had one of those from Marvel Mutants before.
Yep.
Focusing on them and them being just kind of ticked off that they've been kicked out.
Yeah, and that they can't get back to paradise.
And in one or two of the other things I've read, at least one potential character has been clearly set up to go down that path.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. So I'm just so enjoying it. And honestly, out of the 7 issues that have come out of X-Men, I think this is the best one that Hickman's written so far.
I'd have to go back through the other ones. This one had a couple of things that just nagged at me throughout.
Understandable.
I was having a hard time figuring out how much time elapsed. Because okay. We start with a character waking up, so presumably, you know, everyone's there having breakfast or whatever, so I guess it's morning.
Yep.
You know, and then we've got the lounging around scene on the moon, so time's a little different up there, I guess. Okay, fine. We've got then a little later a campfire scene, so yep. Evening or night, maybe?
Possible, yeah. We don't really know where the story's being told. Yeah.
And then we've got the whole crucible part in the arena, and then the aftermath type stuff. And I'm wondering how much time elapsed between the two, because it seemed like everybody was just standing around waiting.
Yeah, pretty much. I took it as like, because it's like almost like a morning till evening, because you have like a dusk scene and the illumination that happens there near the end.
Or maybe a few days later. I don't know. I think
it could be. We don't know. Yeah.
So, I mean, it was an enjoyable issue. I think it certainly addressed some interesting questions, potentially set Nightcrawler off on a very interesting path.
Yes, very much so.
It just left me with some questions. It was good. I wouldn't say it was an amazing issue, but it's one that I think narratively, while they may not reference this specific events here, I expect the Crucible to just be tossed out there as a one-word answer to, hey, when did this character come back, or what happened to this, and why is that undone?
Yeah. Now, also, what was kind of cool for me is this was pure world-building in the truest sense, but at the same time very entertaining in the way he did it. It's not just a, you know, info dump, info dump, info dump. It was more explained in picture narrative, with the way the characters are interacting, you know, with the stories being told of the past around the campfire, when the what happens in the Crucible with the resurrection protocols, all that. It was very engaging while at the same time just being pure world building, which was kind of cool.
There was a few places like the campfire scene where we were told more than shown, but a lot of the whole Crucible stuff was very clearly shown and not told.
Yes.
So I'll give them a pass on the history lesson because you gotta recap it somehow.
Exactly. That almost came off like I can't remember it, but like a scene out of Mad Max Thunderdome when they're around the campfire, the way the people were all shouting out the you know, the words. Mm-hmm. or, you know, the storyteller narrating and the kids shouting it back what happened in the past.
Yeah. It was entertainingly done exposition.
Yeah, I agree.
So this is, it's not going to say this is a game changer because we'd already had the concept of the resurrection protocols and stuff, but it dived into it a bit deeper. It touched on the societal ramifications it seems to be having, which I appreciated. Again, it's not bad. There were one or two things that felt potentially slightly out of touch with one or two of the other books, but not enough to say, oh, that's a problem. It's like, okay, it's just this must take place after this other thing or something.
Yeah.
Which is fine. It was good. I also noticed they didn't mention how often a crucible takes place.
Yeah, that they didn't say. So I'm curious to see, because if this is one a day, that's going to take forever.
Yeah, and I think that's, again, part of why the process is what the process is. But I liked how they left enough things ambiguous that they could play fast and loose with it if they need to.
Exactly.
For me, I'm going to go with a B- on this. I'm enjoying everything they're doing over at the X-Men books. This is one that was very much, again, like you said, world building and a pause to kind of explain some, I don't say backstory stuff, but some context.
Yeah. Well, not to offend you, but we're very far apart this time, as you can tell by my enjoyment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not offending you. No, I gave it an A. I loved it. I love the layers of the story in there. I love the world building. I really enjoyed it. And for the X-Men, it was kind of, it was good. Pretty engaging. I felt like this is the best issue so far of X-Men.
Cool. Glad you liked it. I'm hoping that we see some ramifications of this moving forward, because I think they set up some characters to start going in interesting directions. And while that doesn't make this issue, in my opinion, you know, brilliant or whatever, it really sets up some strong story potential moving forward, which is part of what's making this era of X-Men really good.
I agree wholeheartedly.
Shall we move on to our other book?
Yeah, let's do that.
This is Doctor Tomorrow number 1 from Valiant. Now, I'm still not really getting any Valiant titles on an ongoing basis, but I was curious about this one. I read the 12-issue series of Doctor Tomorrow back in, I think it was 1997 or so. I recall liking it. Don't recall too many specifics about it. And I knew it'd be a reimagining, because this is literally a different Valiant, because that was a claim back in the day. But same,
yeah.
Same sort of universe. They've just rebooted it a few times.
Yeah, rejiggered some things.
Valiant doesn't do much that is blatantly superhero material.
Yeah, I would agree.
Most of their stuff is superhero adjacent, but not the cape and cowl crime fighter type stuff.
No, it tends to more go into the sci-fi, voodoo, technology, and then also you have a little bit of the god stuff, or I guess otherworldly beings with, who's that guy who doesn't die? Ivar Time... No.
Eternal Warrior.
Eternal Warrior, yes. I'm, like, butchering them.
They've got things that look superhero-ish, but aren't standard superheroes.
Exactly. In this one, we do have a superhero.
Yeah. And it's interesting to get the kind of opening scene where we've got all this action and stuff, and then, you know, we cut to kind of, I guess, today or something?
Yeah.
So there's some question as to, what was that opening stuff? Did it happen? When did it happen? Will it happen? Or what? But it's a common technique to open the story with a bang, just to get people interested. Whereas if it had started with this first page of two kids, you know, practicing for baseball or something, it might not have been that exciting of a start for some people.
I agree. And I was surprised. I've been reading more Valiant than I ever have. But I've started to cut back just to the main characters. I call them the main characters. But on that splash page, I knew who a lot of the characters were. I was kind of surprised. I was like, wow, I know that one, that one, that one, that one. So it was kind of funny.
I knew a lot of them. There were a few I wasn't too sure of. Part of that, though, was the art style.
Yeah, the art in here was not to my liking. And it's definitely a step below, a little more cartoonish than anything you see coming out of Valiant.
Cartoonish is the right way to put it. It almost reminds me of...
almost like a manga or an anime type thing. I don't know. I
almost want to say Jeff Smith on some of his more quasi-realistic stuff, like Not Bone. What do you do after that? I don't know. There's something about the art style. It's got a little bit of a cartoony feel to it versus a non-cartoony feel. There's great explanation.
No, but I know what you mean, because almost all the books at Valiant have such a clean line. They're almost like... they're not photo reference, but they could be, because the art is so detailed and such. Here you have the thicker lines, cartoony, the proportions are a little bit out of whack. So it just has that look and feel that is not something I normally gravitate towards.
And it's not bad. And there are certain books I would be very happy with this.
Yes.
But for a Valiant book, it felt a little out of place, and it's like, okay, I recognize some of these, but some of them are not detailed enough or whatever, or look art style-wise different enough that I can't be sure to place them.
Yeah, that's kind of where I was. I was like, I recognize it, but yeah, they look a lot better in their own book.
So I thought this was interesting. Again, the setup for the character of he becomes the hero because he was the hero.
Yeah.
Okay, that works.
I know. I felt like I've read that in another book before somewhere. I can't remember what, but yeah, it's cool. But and then you know, the other, basically a different timeline or a different dimension or a different whatever, a world.
Yeah, I felt a lot of the story here was setting up this kid.
Yeah.
So we knew who he was, his relationship with his dad. Oh, he's bullied. He's got this friend. You know, stuff that is, frankly, almost a little cliche.
Very cliche. That's the word I was going to say. It felt like almost like a by the numbers book, except that it was kind of funny because when they got to the bullying thing, you know, here's these two kids who talk smack to this character, and that character is like ready to pummel him into the ground. I'm like, he's not really getting bullied. He's doing the bullying. and then the bullies have the audacity to keep talking to him after that. It's like, they didn't learn, I guess.
Yeah, apparently not. You know, he decks one, another one says, you know, hey, you know, you're getting help from the girlfriend or whatever. It's like, dude, he's just going to turn around and slug you. I mean, he's shown.
He just knocked out your friend. What are you talking about? Oh, my gosh. That was kind of funny that the bully, or the one that's supposed to be getting bullied, is actually, in my opinion, the bully.
Certainly not the restrained, you know, wimp or something like that.
Yeah, so that was kind of funny.
And then he gets chosen because, well, he'd been chosen.
Yes.
Okay, there's an origin.
I know, because his origin is that you meet yourself, and that doesn't tell us anything about your origin. Maybe that's an issue, too. Who knows?
Well, it happened because it happened.
Exactly. It happened because it happened. There you go. End of story.
Yeah.
Dun-dun.
The complaint I had here is we got a little bit of the, okay, he gets the powers because, well, he's going to be the hero of the story. And then really, aside from the last two pages, it's all set up for that moment.
Yeah.
And then the last two pages, which were cool, again, bringing in another character from another title who should be involved given this sort of a setup, is almost, I don't want to say who's the opposite number or who's the antagonist or whatever, but kinda.
Yeah, I would agree. And so what with me, what happened to this book, okay, I'm looking at all ages art, you know, and all ages writing, and very simplistic, cliched story. It's not really for me because of that. And I felt like I've read all ages books that are written much better, where any age reader could read it. You know, there's some all age books where a kid who's 8 years old or 12 years old or 15 years old can read it and enjoy it. And a guy who's 46 can read it and enjoy it. But this, I felt like maybe a kid who's like, you know, 11 or 10 could enjoy it. But me, I'm just like, I felt like I've read the story before. I've seen all the things in here before. And I'm like, okay, it was a by the numbers thing.
I think the problem was not so much the story, but the execution of it. I think there was a way you could have told this story that felt a little fresher, that seemed a little, I don't know, more accessible, a little more truly all ages.
Yeah, I would agree.
And when you've got the older version of the character giving the younger version of the character the powers and stuff like that, because, well, I'd gotten them at that age or whatever, you could set up a dynamic where there's one read from the kid's point of view and another from that older point of view. And if
exactly.
You relate with the older or the younger character, you get that part of the story better.
Yeah, almost like the movie back in the day, Big, I think it was called.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of fun, you know. You see the kid in the man's body and the man who's in the kid's body and going back and forth. Not that they're changing bodies, but literally this is who you are in years to come. And yeah, that would have been a entertaining read, something that's there that just could have been executed a little bit better than this. I just felt like the execution was way off.
Yeah, well, and again, the whole bit with the dad was heavy exposition and things like that. It was heavy-handed storytelling.
Very heavy-handed. Very heavy-handed. I mean, even to the point where, you know, they're trying to set up and them talking about space and black energy or dark energy. And I'm just like, okay, they don't, like you said, they're just telling you. And almost holding your hand like you're not smart enough to get the story, so I'm going to have to tell you what the story is.
Yeah. And I felt the two pages at the end were a cool epilogue, and I got something out of it because I know enough about the Valiant universe. But if you don't, it will mean nothing to you, I think, and lack kind of the oomph. And where the lead character leaves off here is not one of the, oh, well, I've got to see what happens to him next. He's literally just kind of standing around.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree. So it just left me kind of with a little... I'm just not feeling the passion there. I'm not enjoying myself when I read it. I mean, ultimately, when I sum it up, I'm just like, from the art to the story to the execution, I'm just like, it wasn't bad. It's just not for me.
It wasn't bad, but it certainly wasn't great.
Yeah. And the only people that I could say this would be for is someone maybe younger who's not going to nitpick, because I've gotten to an age where I can see this. And I'm thinking, even as a younger reader, when I think the younger James, I think I could have read something better than this. I'm sure I could have read something better than this. So I don't want to say this is the best book. It's just easy to for them to read it. It's very accessible because they're literally pulling you through this story.
Yeah, I'm curious about the version from, you know, 20 plus years ago. If it was telling more or less the same story and if it told it better. And I'm imagining yes to both.
Yeah, me too.
I don't remember. I've pre-ordered, I think, the second and third issues of this. It's 5 issues. I'll probably just ride it through because I'm not hating it.
Yeah, it's not horrible. Yeah.
But I would like for it to be better.
That's where I am. I think it could be a much better story. It's not bad. It's just the execution of this issue.
I guess the shallow is the word I want to use.
Yeah, shallow. Very shallow.
I didn't really get any kind of depth from any of the characters or the plot or something like that. There's nothing I can really hang my hat on saying. It may not have been great here, but this series is going to be great because, or could be great because.
Yeah, and what's funny is I was all in at Valiant for the longest time, but I'm just like, with so much that I was reading and I'd ordered too much. I stopped. I always do the pre-order bundle of like EXO,
mm-hmm.
Bloodshot, Ray, and who's the, and there's one more I usually get, Eternal Warrior. Those are usually the four that I'll get. But all those other little books I quit buying. And so this was like, probably the first of the Valiant bundles. I didn't get this. So, and after reading this, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, yeah. I'm trying to, you know, when I see something that looks interesting, Valiant, to sample it, maybe to dip my toes back in the water, but there's not been anything yet because we tried one or two other things. I guess it was Visitor we tried.
Yeah, that wasn't that great either.
And it's, yeah, there hasn't been enough to really get me back in there on a regular basis.
Well, the thing that's coming up that I'm really on board for is going to be the new EXO when that comes out.
We should definitely keep an eye on that and see if we can maybe review that first. I think we can get a press PDF or something of it.
Yeah, because Valiant usually has good stuff.
And EXO is one of their anchor characters.
Exactly. I would say it's probably one of their flagship characters.
Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah.
This is one that I could see being charitable and giving it a better score than I'm going to. But really, this is one that... It wasn't bad, but I do think it could have been written tighter, drawn a little bit better, edited a lot better to really tighten up the story, dump some of the exposition, show us a bit more and stuff. I'm going to have to go with a C+ on this. I liked it. I'm not going to say I totally recommend it.
You know what's funny? I sounded like I hated it, and I did not hate this book. It was not broken, but it's just really not for me. And if anyone's asking me, this is not something I'd steer them towards. And I was charitable. I was like, C+. I almost gave it a C, but I was like, C+, because it's not horrible. It's just not for me.
It was not inspired.
It was not inspired at all. So I'm hoping for something better from Valiant in the near future, and I think EXO might be the thing, because there are some books from them that I'm really enjoying, including Ray, R-A-I.
Cool.
Rye, Ray.
Ray. There are multiple pronunciations. I've heard it both ways.
Yeah, however you want to say it, that's the one I like right now.
That's fair.
Cool. So, what's been going on with you, John?
So, we've had a few episodes that were a little different format and stuff last couple of weeks. I took some time off, took a trip, went down to New Zealand with my family.
Awesome.
Basically, we flew from Austin through LAX down to Auckland, hopped on a cruise ship, sailed on it for a bit. It got all the way to Sydney, where we saw the Opera House and a cool-looking bridge and stuff. Actually, I posted a photo of the bridge. And then we basically turned around, sailed back to Auckland, and then hopped on a plane and flew back. It took quite a bit of time.
That's got to be like a 4-week cruise.
It was.
That's awesome.
Technically, one cruise from Auckland to Sydney, and then another cruise from Sydney back to Auckland. We figured if we're going to fly that far and put up with that jet lag, let's make it worth the while.
Yeah, I think it was like 6 years ago, my wife and I, we went on Holland America, that I think the cruise line you went on, but we just did the Auckland over to Sydney, and that's it, you know, the 2 weeks.
Yeah, we did that, and then, like I said, turned around and went back. Slightly different ports on the two legs.
Oh, cool.
We hit Tauranga, Napier, Wellington, Akaroa, Port Chalmers. Got to Oban, but it was just rough enough that, well, we could anchor the ship fine. The tenders weren't safe, so they said we just basically didn't do tenders. So we just sat there in the port, which I was okay with. I hate tenders. I just don't really like them. So
yeah,
I basically
they're not fun.
Sat up in the crow's nest, kind of their lounge area at the top of the front of the ship, and read a book for the day.
Oh, nice.
Then we went to Eden, and yes, I did see the Garden of Eden. I didn't have a camera ready. It was a trailer park. I will look it up on Google Maps, though, just for the hell of it. We then hit Sydney, which was the turnaround day, and where most people were getting off, but 19 of us were staying on. And then back to Port Arthur, Hobart. We went to Hobart between Oban and Eden. And then after Hobart, we did Oban again, actually getting into Oban this time, Port Chalmers, Akaroa, Wellington, Napier, Tauranga again. We also had a couple of sea days and a couple of days where we were cruising the Fiordland National Park and Milford Sound and some stuff like that.
Nice.
It was nice. It was relaxing. And I forget which day it was. I think it was when we were in the Fiordland National Park.
Yeah.
I was up again in the crow's nest, had my Kindle with me. I was reading. And they had the naturalist, you know, spouting about, oh, well, this was discovered by this guy at this point. It had stuff, so he called it the Bay of Plenty or whatever. Maybe it was a different bay. But basically, the guy who named all the stuff, not creative at all. And at one point, she's talking and stuff. Oh, there are some dolphins. And I'm like, oh, that looks cool. I look out. And there were like, I don't know, 15 or 20 of them near the ship, just jumping, doing all kinds of stuff. And I didn't have my camera, but I had my Kindle, so I got a video of it. I haven't pulled it off the Kindle yet. I'll see if it turned out. If so, I'll post it on the Slack channel, maybe.
Yeah, I'd like to see that. That'd be really cool.
And I think my sister got some good photos with an actual camera.
See, you lucked out because you went to the fjords. When my wife and I, we went there, we went down all the way down to Dunedin there in the South Island. And we were supposed to go down around the fjords. And the seas were so rough. There was like 40-foot swells that it came back up north. And we went between the two islands and then all the way over to Tasmania, the island of Tasmania.
Interesting.
They're like, if we go that way, we're going to have a lot of people sick, and it's very dangerous. I'm like, yeah, let's turn around.
Well, we did go to Hobart, which is in Tasmania, and we had the sea days before that. And going over, it was not too bad. Coming back, it was a lot rougher. And even when we were in Hobart the second time, because after Sydney coming back, we went to Port Arthur in the morning, and then that night we docked at Hobart, stayed there overnight. Even docked at Hobart, it was kind of bouncy.
Wow. Hobart, I remember it was really fun. We had a lot of fun there. It's pretty.
And then we went to Port Chalmers, which is just outside of Dunedin.
Oh, nice. That's really nice.
So, all kinds of cool stuff. Very relaxing. Excellent food for the most part on the ship. One of the chefs in the Lido practically adopted my sister and I with our food allergies. And, man, we ate so well there, it's not even funny.
That's awesome. So lots of gluten-free stuff for you.
Tons. Fish and chips. We had onion rings one time. Pasta. Trying to think what else. The only thing, and I knew when I asked, because it was on the menu, the way it works on Holland America with food allergies is typically they'll give you tomorrow's menu at dinner for the next night's dinner in the dining room.
Yeah.
And you order a day early.
Oh, that's cool. So they prepare it for you. Make sure that it's there.
It gives them a little time to figure out how they're going to adjust for allergies and stuff.
That's awesome.
So when I saw lasagna one night, it's like, I know you're not going to be able to do this, but I'm going to ask anyways. And of course, they couldn't do that. And my mom's like, well, I can do it. It's like, yeah, Mom, but they don't have that many grocery stores right here in the middle of the water. That was the only thing they really couldn't do for me, though.
But everything else, that's really
everything
awesome.
Else, I was really well fed, really happy with that. Came back weighing within about a half a pound of what I weighed going out. So I was surprised and happy with that, too.
That's awesome. That's hard to do on a four-week cruise, come back the same weight.
It is. We did a ton of walking around in some of these ports. And just on the ship, it's, you know, you got to walk the length of the ship just to get to dinner and get into breakfast and all that kind of stuff.
That's really cool. I'm glad you got away and had some fun.
Oh, yeah. It was good good family time for my mom, my sister, and I. We kind of needed that. Took the Kindle and stuff, so I read a ton of books.
Oh, cool. So, are you going to be doing any podcasts on those?
We did three more of the Lost Fleet books for the Genesis Fleet stuff, so I've got to pull those off the recorder and edit those. We also did two Star Trek novels, one of which I may try to get up sooner rather than later.
Cool.
And then I read a bunch of other books and some other stuff.
Awesome. Well, I'm looking forward to them.
Yeah, so it was a lot of fun. Anything happened while I was gone?
Surprising that you ask. Literally, it felt like kind of like all hell broke loose, you know, in a way. First, you know, we were talking and you'd sent me some news while you're on the ship about the generations coming out, about mm-hmm. the five different generations. And we were talking about, oh, let's have a round table and talk about this. And then shortly after that, Dan Didio is fired from
yeah.
DC.
I had internet on the ship more for download than upload. The upload sucked, but I was following bits and pieces of the Slack conversation on that and chimed in once or twice. But yeah, his departure seemed both expected and surprising.
That's the way most people have taken it. Expected and surprising. I mean, apparently, you know, some talent he's rubbed the wrong way, obviously. I mean, that happens probably with any publisher or editor in chief. But, I think it was coming because, you know, he was at the forefront of the New 52 and, you know, say what you will, you know, it excited a lot of people, brought a lot of people back, ultimately kind of fizzled out and they went back with Rebirth. And we've heard rumblings that a lot of people were not on board with this whole 5G about maybe sidelining a lot of the main characters and going new characters to replace them.
He's been co-publisher for like 10 or 12 years now, but he had the reins on the DC Universe further back. So he was one of the architects of the 52 stuff.
Yeah.
1 year later, the Forever Evil stuff, which had some major status quo change for various characters. Again, as you mentioned, the New 52, which was a major reboot of the universe. Rebirth, which was an attempt to kind of fix it. And for my money, he's done some good stuff. But it's also kind of schizophrenic. He'll do some stuff in what I think is the right direction and then other stuff that I think is totally in the wrong direction, sometimes simultaneously, sometimes one right after another, kind of going away and then undoing it.
Yeah, almost like he's not afraid to make a decision and go with it, and this is the way we're going, you know, regardless of the way you feel about it, this is what we're going to do. And when you're working with creative people, maybe not the best way to go about things. And then, but at the same time, he gets it done, but then he has to fix a lot of the errors if he takes the wrong path. And
I think
maybe
it's less taking the wrong path than not keeping his eye on the ball.
That too, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
A lot of the justification they gave for the New 52 was their characters had gotten into places they didn't think they should ever have been.
Yep.
To which the question is, well, how did that happen, and how are you going to make sure it doesn't happen again?
Yeah, and this felt like, we don't really know, but we're only hear rumors, but maybe, you know, putting the main characters on the side where they live in a pocket dimension and people can go and revisit the old characters and here's a story here and there, and going with new characters, that sounded like something very dangerous for DC to be doing.
Yes.
And what I mean by that is I think you had the potential, especially, you know, you look at market share and what it is right now, of actually alienating long-term readers, which is what DC is holding onto right now, the base of their long-term readers who really love the company and love the characters. And if you alienate them, that's really dangerous because I don't know that there's going to be a ton of new readers coming in to read these brand new characters like we just saw with the new age of DC characters. You know, not many people came to read those.
Well, I don't know that they're going for the long-term hardcore readers. They're going for the new readers and that middle ground.
Yeah.
Those that came on during DDO's reign.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I look at some of the stuff, again, the DC New Age of Heroes or wherever it was that had so many forgettable characters. The Terrifics are the only title that has survived out of that.
Yep, that was it.
And even that's not what it originally was.
And you have a token popping up of some of these other characters here and there, but it's very rare.
Silencer is the only one I think even gets a token pop-up. A lot of them are...
Yeah, Brimstone's gone. I haven't seen that character. I mean, yeah, they're just kind of into the ether.
We might get Sideways in a Titans issue or something like that soon. I don't know. But yeah, most of them are off on the sidelines and such. But it just seems like there's not a cohesive vision for what the DC Universe is, could be, or should be. And, you know, having some spare time on the cruise, knowing that this was going on, I was idly thinking, well, if for some crazy reason I was in charge, what would I do, you know? And the one thing I came up with is basically I would put something in place to save me from myself. Because, well, I know what I think the DC Universe ought to be. That's my opinion, and maybe it's not the prevailing one.
Yeah, it's true.
I would put together a council of people that are, for lack of any other term, kind of the guardians of the universe.
Yeah, like a Greg Rucka or a whoever.
I was thinking specifically Marv Wolfman.
Marv Wolfman, yes.
George Perez, Mark Waid.
Mark Waid would be excellent.
Peter David. I'm trying to think if there were a couple others. Certainly Rucka, Bendis would be in there, probably Scott Snyder. Not too many of them would be current active writers and such.
It would be the old guard who had been there for years and seen the characters develop over the years.
And we were going to go down that road 20, 30 years ago, but didn't because.
Yeah, they've probably been and done what, or thought about doing what he's done, and maybe this is why they didn't do it.
Or they didn't think about it, but they could say, you know, it's a good reason because, or it's a bad reason because.
Exactly. And you want to know what? Sometimes, you know, as a CEO or as a publisher, you need that sounding board. You really do. Even me, you know, owning my business is like, I have people that I go to and I bounce ideas off of because they see and think about things completely differently than I do.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives me a different perspective. And then sometimes I go along with what I'm going to do. A lot of times I change it. A lot of times I morph the two ideas together.
Exactly. You know, because I think part of what was problematic during DiDio's tenure is he was not a fan of sidekicks.
Nope.
But a lot of those,
to kill him off.
Yeah, a lot of those sidekicks had become major characters.
Yeah, like Nightwing.
Nightwing, Kid Flash who became Flash, Speedier Arsenal, even the next round of teen characters had grown up to become successful with the Teen Titans and Young Justice and stuff like that. And to just, you know, keep tossing them to the side, pull them back to toss them to the side again, it's like, come on.
Yeah.
So, and I was saying this before going on the trip, it's not a question of should DiDio leave, and is the problem even him, maybe it was something else, but if there's going to be a regime change at DC, and I think we all knew that they needed one, what does that new regime need to do? What do we want out of the DC universe to be happy with it? And all of us are going to have different answers. The question is there a common enough consensus that could please enough of us for it to continue being a viable thing for the long term?
Yeah, I agree. And one thing that kind of came up, the chatter all over, you know, message boards, Slack, and, you know, podcasts all around, people were always like, who's going to replace them? Who's going to replace them? And to my knowledge and what I've heard is AT&T, Time Warner, DC, whoever you want to say, they're not going to replace them. They're going to have one publisher, and that's going to be Jim Lee.
If you think about it, it's the anomaly to have co-publishers.
It really is. So you literally, they kind of had Jim Lee. He's like, oh, I dealt with the artist and Dan dealt with the writers. But now really you should have one person making decisions and one, you know, person to go to, one person who's in charge. It's very weird to have, two CEOs or two chiefs in the, you know, there's usually one chief, one person in charge. And so that, I think that's what they're going to do going forward, because to me that didn't make any sense. I've never seen a publishing company with two publishers.
What I would do is I would certainly hang on to Jim Lee as a publisher. The guy is crazy talented both as an artist, and look at the tenure he had running Wildstorm as his own company and such, and what he's done back with DC afterwards and such.
Yeah.
But I think he would be well advised to get somebody under him as kind of a creative coordinator to keep track of what the hell is going on in every DC book, DC
yes.
Universe type stuff, and keep it cohesive, keep it tight, make sure we're not seeing, you know, three competing stories of the same villain at the same time or things like that. And, you know, can field the lower level minutia questions while, hey, these big decisions of do we really want to go this way with this character? Kick that up to Jim Lee or somebody, but not have him get kind of stuck in the weeds on all of it.
I would agree. I think that would be the best thing for him to do. And one interesting thing, the only thing that I've heard out of Jim Lee is that he kind of alluded to the 5G is going forward, but it may be just these one-shot stories, these things that happen, whereas the main universe stays the same. So I think he basically said, we're so far with these stories and this Generation 1, Generation 2, we can't pull back on that. The creators have been paid. The stories are ready to go to press. They're being solicited. But I think he's almost going to do them as like an Elseworlds type story while maintaining and keeping and maybe reinvigorating the properties that we have now.
And this is one of the things that I think is symptomatic of DC's struggle.
Yeah, the back and forth.
Because you go with, okay, let's kick some of the main characters out for a year for this 1 year later. Let's do the 52 story, all that kind of stuff. It was cool. It was interesting. But it said the problem is our main characters. You do things like Trinity, which is the same sort of a story. That was the weekly book, not the later book. And there was enough things for a while that it almost seemed like the core characters were seen as the problem. Then it gets to the new 52 where it's, you know what, it's our continuity. Let's just kick it all out and start over. And then we get to Rebirth with, yeah, we threw a little too much out with the bathwater. We're going to put some of it back because maybe that'll appease people. Started going in the right direction, then kind of went a little haywire with that, with the let's switch Supermans. Do they like each other with Batman and Superman? Do they not? Can they get along? Whatever. This back and forth oscillation is killing it. And now the current mantra that DiDio had been presenting of it all happened, it all matters, seems to be such an about face from the chuck it all and restart it all with New 52. I don't want either extreme.
No, yeah, you don't need to be in either extreme. It's weird. I'm hoping Jim Lee can write the ship, because if he can't, honestly, he's probably the next to go, because they need somebody who can almost keep the ship on a steady course, bring in new talent, get people who are excited to write the books, to write the characters, to draw the characters, and listen to them, because they're going to have way better ideas than you do, Jim Lee. And honestly, at the publishing level, that's not where the creative ideas should be coming from.
The creative ideas shouldn't be coming from there, but there needs to be rails around what can be done. Yes. So you don't get Hal Jordan, intergalactic villain.
Yeah, they set the boundaries, and inside those boundaries, have at it.
And there are times you can push the boundaries, but it's got to be carefully thought out as to, is it a good story, and what are the long-term ramifications?
Exactly.
If we do this to a character, does it kind of mandate, because of the global mindshare inertia, that it gets undone? Because, well, the character's not that way.
True.
You know, it's the electric blue Superman type stuff. That was never going to be Superman's permanent status quo.
Yeah,
it would
that's
be
true.
Rejected by the global consciousness.
Yeah, nobody wants to see that.
That could be a fun story, but it's a short-term story.
Very true. And you wanted to let it was kind of funny. When you just saying that, when the latest Superman movie came out, and you know, it basically was showing Superman as a alien coming down, which he's always been an alien, but you know, with the spaceships and the laser fights and things like that, I was surprised how many people who are not into comics, who don't watch even comic movies, but grew up watching Superman in the 1980s, you know, the Superman movies. Mm-hmm. They're like, what is this nonsense? This isn't Superman. Even they, you know, they know who Superman is, and you show them something that's so completely different, they reject it.
That's, I think, the crux of the problem with DC, is I think there is this core aspect of every character, every property they've got, that most people would look at and say, you know, you can be a little off the mark, but if you're generally hitting the bullseye, or at least on the same target, you're good.
Yeah.
It's when you come at it from, you know, a completely backwards angle or off axis that people are like, what the hell?
Exactly. What is this? I don't recognize it. It's not good. This is not what I grew up with. This and people
or it's
who,
good, but it's not that property.
Yeah, it's not that. And so the people who do enjoy it are like, wow, this is cool. I remember that stuff, but this is more action-oriented maybe. But, I mean, the bulk of people are not going to enjoy that. They kind of gravitate towards what they know, but make it entertaining and tell me a new story with something that I know. And that brings them to a comforting, warm spot of nostalgia mixed with a good story. And I think once you get to the nostalgia mixed with a good story, you can do great things.
You've got to have a look at continuity that goes forward as well as backward. You need to know where you've been, but more importantly, you've got to know where this is going to push you to go next.
Exactly. And if you do that, I think you can do great things. And I really think we're starting to see that played out a little bit more at Marvel right now. Marvel has not always been there. They actually did away with most of their main heroes a little while back. Didn't go too well for them. And I was honestly worried with DC going the way that they were getting ready to go with the 5G, if that's what they were really intending to do, scrap the old characters. I thought that could be the nail in the coffin.
Yeah, and not only could it be the nail in the coffin for DC, potentially, if that's what they were going to do, but it's a small pond in a pretty big ripple.
Yeah, that could have lasting repercussions to where we don't have print media anymore.
Yeah.
And that's kind of scary. And maybe powers, you know, that be saw that and let's nip this in the bud right now.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what they do, how far down the road they are. And the whole concept, well, it'll just be its own little side stuff that just throws confusion into the water and doesn't help. It keeps going with that general confusion as to what is DC.
Yeah, and Dan Didio is going to be fine. I know he's going to be moving on to his next thing. He gets a golden parachute. He was an executive at a company. So I wish him and his family the best, but I do think it's a good thing for DC to have a new publisher and a new dawn of DC.
Yeah, we'll just see what direction, once things kind of stabilize, where Jim Lee kind of wants to take it, and what happens from there.
Fingers are crossed.
Yeah. Okay, so the March previews came out on February 26th. Its deadline was March 7th. I'm going to push that back a week for a couple of reasons.
Yeah.
One, I haven't gotten any clips yet. Two, when I made this decision yesterday on Wednesday the 4th, only one person had posted on the forum saying they were going to send in clips. So I'm like, well, that's not good. I haven't gotten my previews. As a matter of fact, I just got that today. I know a lot of other people are in the same boat, and it just seemed like a good idea. So I'm giving people until Saturday morning, March 14th, bright and early. I do need to remember to go change the deadline on the Dropbox submission form and stuff, so it'll actually accept it for that long. Regular format, one clip per pick. This is, again, Preview Spotlight 149 for the March previews. Please send some stuff in. These episodes only work if you guys send stuff in.
Yeah, and I will be sending in stuff. I'm one of those guys who got previews late, and I was gone for a week. Your last week of vacation I was gone too.
Oh, yeah.
So, couldn't do it.
Stuff happens, not a big deal. I am starting to use MailChimp to send out the reminders stuff.
Cool.
I'm working on putting a thing to where on the front page of the website you could just toss your email address in and get added to the list. Still working through figuring out MailChimp and stuff, but that's probably what I'm going to use moving forward. If you've got thoughts, like it, don't like it, things I should do differently, let me know. I'll see what I can do. And then next month we're going to be hitting issue or episode 150 of the Preview Spotlight. So let's have a good turnout for 149. Again, that deadline is March 14th, and hopefully we'll have a really good turnout for the one after it too.
Exactly. A big anniversary issue. Let's do it.
Yeah. So anything else? Are we good?
We're good.
Cool. Join us next time as we discuss Flash number 750 from DC, 2020 Rescue number 1 from Marvel, and Join the Future number 1 from Aftershock.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.